This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Bill V. Mullen. He's professor of English and director of American Studies at Purdue University. Mullen's the author of Afro-Orientalism, as well as other titles, including Popular Front, Chicago and African-American Cultural Politics. He's also edited or co-edited several other books on African-Americans and radical politics, including the fascinating book Left of the Color Line, Race, Radicalism, and 20th Century Literature of the U.S. Bill V. Mullen, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get to the present in a hurry with the upcoming inauguration of Barack Obama. What do you make of the significance of his election?
Well, I mean, it's huge. There's no doubt about it. My partner compared this to the moment colonialism fell in India, in the sense that you've got this, the central issue of race, which has divided the nation and made this moment seem impossible, has suddenly transformed itself into something that I think most of us didn't think we were going to see. It's a great victory, I think, on one hand for people who are working against racism in the United States. I also think that people need to be very wary about how quickly they celebrate. Obama is shaping up to be a Clintonian centrist. I think a lot of progressives and leftists are going to end up being disappointed. I think he has shown an inclination, a McCain-like inclination, to support this two-front war in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, in the second debate, he seemed to want to cut his credentials as a commander-in-chief in even sharper terms than McCain by insisting that he was ready to redeploy to Afghanistan. I think the question we're confronting right now is are we going to have a kind of friendly, cooler version of American empire that's going to be able to package itself and sell itself around the globe? And I think the possibilities for progressives and leftists around the globe to be disappointed is really something we need to watch out for.
Yeah, we have an article in the latest issue of The Progressive by Eduardo Galeano called Hopes and Fears, and he talks about his hopes that Obama will deconstruct the U.S. empire and his fear, overwhelming, that he won't. And I think he's absolutely right that he won't. He's going to run the empire just as Bill Clinton did, a little less recklessly than Bush and Cheney did. But
I think so.
I've always thought that he's going to be an amalgam in foreign policy of Bill Clinton and H.W. Bush.
Yeah, I think it's also possible that he can siphon off a lot of really good left progressive activism. I think, obviously, the queer movement already has huge reasons to be skeptical about this guy who ran on an incredibly conservative, pro-family, anti-gay marriage platform. I think that's the other thing about November 4th that we're going to have to look kind of back dialectically. Where was the civil rights struggle at this moment for gay rights? I think that struggle is going to be won, too, but Obama's done nothing to advance that. In fact, he's pushed it back, absolutely.
Yeah, November 4th, it was one huge turn around a corner for progress and missing a turn.
Absolutely.
Another turn. And that's the tragedy of that day. Now, you told me before we started this interview that you knew Obama in college and a little bit later. What kind of a guy is he? I've never met him.
Cool, friendly, cerebral. When I knew him at Occidental and then afterwards in New York, he was actually most interested in becoming a writer. He wrote a lot of poetry and fiction when he was a college student. I was doing the same when I was in New York, when he was finishing at Columbia. A lot of our conversations were about literature. Nobody from my generation that knew him at that time, I think, would have predicted not only his presidency, but even in a career in politics. But he left New York and went to Chicago, and I think that was a life-changing experience when he got into community organizing. And I only saw him once after that. I was actually doing my research on Popular Fronts, and he had already become a full-time community organizer there. And I could see that his life trajectory had changed, and he was definitely committed to that kind of work. I certainly didn't see this, though.
Was he cautious then in kind of a political calculating way, or was come later?
Nobody who knew him, I think, thought of him as an ambitious guy. That's the thing, you know. He either hit it brilliantly or had a real life change, as he's tried to describe in his books. He said when he moved to Columbia, it was living in Harlem that kind of recentered questions of race and social justice. That's perfectly plausible to me. And I think when he went to Chicago, he had the best intentions, I think, actually, to sort of try to pick up on the legacy of the voter registration drives in the 1960s, which I think if there's something that's kind of like has a permanent glow about it, about this election, there's a way in which his campaign recaptured some of the meaning of the vote, particularly for African Americans. And I think that started for him in Chicago.
Speaking with Bill Mullen, you know, he's still interested in poetry, evidently, because he was caught carrying around a poetry book of Derek Walcott after the election. So maybe there's hope there. Other people vest hope in him, knowing that he has at least a familiarity with leftist politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you one anecdote, because I wrote my first book, Popular Front, was about the left progressive and communist influence cultural work among African Americans on the south side of Chicago in the 1940s. Frank Marshall Davis, who was a black poet and journalist of that time, very active in Chicago, eventually joined the CP and then moved to Hawaii. And most people think that in Obama's autobiography, the man named Frank, who he refers to as somebody who was sort of a mentor to him, was Frank Marshall Davis, who remained active he was a political journalist and wrote a labor column in the Honolulu paper there. And I think if you listen to Obama's rhetoric about change comes from below, a lot of us want to say, well, that's Saul Alinsky or that's Karl Marx. Well, you know, it's some combination of them. It's Obama's version of that.
Howard Zinn, too.
And Howard Zinn. Yeah. But I think this is the question. I mean, hitch a revolution from below to empire? It's a contradiction in terms that seems irresolvable to me.
And revolution from below that's just attached to a person rather than a movement.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the Obama campaign was hero worship, kind of.
Yeah,
it wasn't about building a structure. I felt similarly about Nader after he left the Green Party.
Absolutely.
It was just about Nader. I mean, let's build something here.
I think that's why people are quickly getting suspicious about all these Clinton appointees. Like, his notion of a Democratic party structure seems to be one that we've already lived through in the 1990s.
And like Clinton, I mean, Clinton was familiar with the left, too.
Absolutely.
But discarded it.
Absolutely.
And the concern is that Obama, with his cautiousness and his temperamental kind of don't rock the boat, is just going to go along with the establishment and run the empire, maybe be a little more Keynesian than a Republican would be with the economy, but certainly not doing anything dramatic. So, I mean, I think some of us went into the election kind of with eyes open, knowing that he wasn't going to really change capitalism or empire, and yet understood, as you pointed out, Bill Mullen, that this is a huge kind of step forward on the racial front that is less, you know, racism is such a scar in this country that to get over that scar a little bit even, it's a huge, huge boost.
But we also have to remember that this is a guy who never made his campaign about race and never said, I'm running for the non-white minority in this country. And I think I want to speak about this a little bit this afternoon at my campus talk. I think he really reinforced some hostile notions about Arab Americans and Islamophobia in his campaign.
How so?
Well, you remember the episode in Detroit where his campaign people moved some women out of camera shot because they had headscarves. He distanced himself from Jeremiah Wright, I think partly because Wright was, among other things, a critic of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. He backgrounded heavily his father's story, his Muslim side, as it were, and really foregrounded the story of his mother and his grandmother. And he was strident in affirming his Christianity. I don't think I've seen a candidate work so hard to convince us. Now, he's running in a moment of Islamophobia and terrorist hysteria, but I don't think he did much to answer that with a productive way of thinking about Arab Americans' ethnicity globally, and I think ultimately helped. This was a kind of a move that I think allows him to remain that two-front Middle East warrior in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's really disturbing to me.
I mean, and he never said, you know, what if I was Muslim?
Exactly.
I'm not Muslim, but,
exactly.
You know, what if I was?
Yeah. He enabled the vacuum that people like Sarah Palin filled with their racist garbage.
And yet I worry about a racist backlash from those people who were at the Sarah Palin crowds.
Well, I teach at Purdue, as you know, and the night Obama was elected, there's a tree called the Landmark Tree on our campus, which is where African-American Latino students historically congregate, and they often paint the tree with, you know, cultural signs, you know, historical events, black history, et cetera. The morning after the election, there was somebody had written an obscenity and with Obama's name and drawn a huge male genitalia, and the black students on campus were outraged. And we had a rally of about 200 people called within 3 days of that event, a very mixed race rally, also involving some queer students who had been involved in another sort of hate episode. And as I said to, you know, one of the local reporters, there's almost never been a civil rights gain in the United States that hasn't come with a huge backlash. And I think we're going to see some of that elsewhere.
I mean, it seems to me, Bill Mullen, that the backlash is going to take at least a couple forms. One is this virulent kind of explicit racism.
Yeah.
Another is a little less conscious, and it's going to be, well, look, you got a black guy in the Oval Office.
Right.
We don't need affirmative action.
Exactly.
You know, we've overcome
racism.
Racism
is over.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do you counter that?
Well, I think you have to come back, if you're Obama, to taking seriously some of what you said in Philadelphia about making race certainly central to the conversation about the country and the culture. And frankly, the statistics on African-American education, unemployment, structural violence against people of color, the stats are almost as bad now as they were in many ways during the 1960s, particularly that massive growth at the bottom. And we could also look at Latinos, right, in places like South Texas, the poorest of the poor. There has to be a conversation about structural racism and the violence it's doing to the lives of non-white people. It is absolutely fundamental. So if this moment passes, and really the most reactionary interpretation of Obama's election is that we've gotten over race, which I think liberals and conservatives would really like to believe, that would be a disaster.
I'm speaking with Bill Mullen. He's professor of English and director of American Studies at Purdue University. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. Some black intellectuals criticized Obama during the campaign. I'm thinking of Adolf Reed, for instance, and activists like Kevin Alexander Gray for going out of his way to criticize African Americans in front of African Americans.
Yeah, right.
Jesse Jackson most luridly made a remark about this.
Yeah.
But other than that kind of outrageous comment, I mean, the criticism seemed to me to be on target in that way. I thought Obama might have been fueling this, we're beyond racism.
You know, I think what he did, and I was thinking about this, he clearly used the family. And I think these people like Reed are talking about his standing up in black churches and talking about black fathers needing to take more responsibility. It seems to me he marshaled the most conservative ideology of the family as a way of basically establishing his national belonging. That is to say, his patriotism. I'm an American. He wasn't going to ever pass as white, but I think this discourse was crucial to him de-exoticizing himself, de-Islamicizing himself. You know, the family, as we sort of say in cultural studies, is oftentimes kind of a metaphor for the nation. And he has made his family, as it were, a trope of Americanness. And I think that that is a fundamentally reactionary strategy. And I think it's consistent with the fact that, for example, he's not supporting gay marriage.
He was trying, in my opinion, to make himself acceptable. Comfortable.
Absolutely.
Make white people comfortable with. I'm not like those other black guys.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And now it's going to be hard for him to address white America and insist, as he did in Philadelphia, that look, we still have problems here. I mean, maybe he's gifted oratorically. Maybe he can do it. But
I think the other thing to say here is this: Obama is not going to solve our problems, right? We know that. And if this election means anything, it means the possibility for continuous strands of mass political activity that may take on new lives of their own, okay? If that happens, if these people that threw themselves into the Democratic Party as if it was their last salvation, if they begin to step back and maintain social commitments to work on poverty, racism, gay marriage, that's a terrific thing. You know, that, and that has really, in the final analysis, nothing to do with Obama. And in fact, I think it would be a healthier thing if it didn't have anything to do with Obama.
You know what I fear is going to happen, though, and you see this sometimes in Air America, for instance, which I think played a healthy role in the waning Bush years and helped galvanize people to get rid of the Bush-Cheney regime, is that they're going to just defend Obama no matter what.
Sure.
And that that's going to be the acceptable, furthermost left plank in American mainstream political conversation.
Yeah.
And it's going to be Obama against the world.
Yeah.
And you got to help Obama here rather than criticize him. I know we heard that during the campaign. How dare you criticize Obama during the campaign?
Yeah. I mean, I would say another analogy would be not just Clinton move, you know, who has moved the left to the right, as it were, but in the UK, what Tony Blair did with the Labour Party was pretty unconscionable, really defanging the role of the working class, really turning its back on the people that historically built a party. Blair was happy to invoke that tradition, but he has run much more as a Thatcherite than he has a traditional Labourite. And I shudder to think that Obama might betray his backers, particularly backers of color. You know, 95% of African Americans voted for the man, but I think they're going to want something in return, and they have every right to.
And how do we, how do they, how do we all on the progressive side demand this of him?
Absolutely.
And force him to come to the table?
This is a huge question. And I think, you know, again, you think about after how much, this is maybe a bad analogy, but 9/11 did a lot to kill off the progressive movement that it started with, say, Seattle, right? I hope Inauguration Day is not the day that this activist euphoria, as it were, that it really is there. And I can tell you, I saw it in my students. I saw it in graduate students. I saw it in people who got very much involved in politics for the first time in their life. It's a great thing. But if it all goes away after January 20th, then we really haven't gained very much.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the euphoria when Clinton was there.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
You know, people were memorizing the Maya Angelou inauguration poem. It wasn't a great poem either, for that matter.
Yeah.
But
yes.
That faded fast. And this was a bigger moment. I mean, I was euphoric on November 5th. But we've got to have our eyes open. That's
absolutely
crucial.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Bill Mullen, academic at Purdue University who has a history of radical politics. How'd you get into radical politics?
Life experience, you know, growing up in a lower middle class Southern California environment where there was a lot of racism all around me in public schools in the 1970s. I went to a junior high school that went through a busing experiment that was really tough on all the kids. Learned a lot about white racism, seeing it every day firsthand, and then moved to New York and became involved in left-wing organized politics, which was sort of a changing moment in my life. About this time I got into graduate school. Graduate school had something to do with it. At least it was a place to read Marx in peace. And really, I haven't really gone back since then. That was 1984.
And what is the relevance of Marx today, do you think? I mean, he's not someone that people talk outside of the academy talk about a lot.
Marx has never been more relevant. I mean, what we've seen since September is really the closest thing to a Marxist prediction of capital's contradictions. We've seen overproduction. We've seen underconsumption. We've seen massive inequalities of wealth now that are global, which are coming home to roost, not just in the United States, India, Latin America. We have never seen China. I'll take one example. I think China actually holds out tremendous potential right now for another major working class revolution. There was a protest of 10,000 people in Northwest China did it just because the government, the provincial government, was moving its office from one city to another, and people thought it was going to cost them jobs. 10,000 people on the streets.
Yeah, the other shoe's going to drop in China sometime soon.
Yeah, and you know, China is trying to sort of secede, as it were, from the global economic crisis, but their internal crisis is so profound right now. that I think that, you know, you don't even have to be a Marxist to necessarily understand that that country is not going to be able to resolve and satisfactorily deal with this incredible unemployment crisis that it's facing right now.
And here in the United States, I mean, to see Henry Paulson at work is really to see the proof of Marx's line that the state is but the executive committee of the ruling class.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think just to speak too about race, you know, I mean, Marx's great argument that, you know, white workers will never be free while black workers are in chains. I mean, I think what we've seen in Latin America over the last 10 years, this kind of massive upsurge of a basically a colonized part of the world should give us extraordinary hope. And these revolutions in Venezuela and Bolivia are resonating with Americans. They're resonating with the working class in the UK, Scotland. I mean, I think it's a point. Globalization has made us actually understand dialectics much more easily. We see it being played out every single day on television, in the newspapers. Even the bourgeois press, like the New York Times, is a way of looking into the mirror of capitalist contradictions.
You've written a lot. It's interesting you're talking about Latin America. You've written a lot about Afro-Asian alliances, and I wondered why it was not just, Afro-Third World, for instance, why the focus on Asia versus Latin America.
Well, it started out as my research on that, on Afro-Asia, started out as a pedagogical exercise. I was going to China in 1997 rather, to teach African-American literature. I wanted to bring to my students a backstory about black American writers and China and Asia. And I unearthed this pretty extraordinary tradition of collaboration and exchange that became the subject of my second book. And there was so much to it, it merited an entire book, which is the book Afro-Orientalism. I start with W.E.B. Du Bois, who I argue ultimately came to socialism through his observation of the socialist movement in India at the turn of the century, which was a tremendously hopeful thing for Du Bois, the Russian Revolution of 1917, which he wrote a brilliant novel in the aftermath of called Dark Princess, which is a novel about a black working class train porter and an Indian revolutionary who planned the overthrow of global capitalism. And this is in the 1920s. And then finally, the 1949 revolution in China, which was the tipping point for Du Bois. There was no going back to any compromise with capitalism after he saw, I think, the success of socialism and communism primarily in the Asian world. And I would argue that Russia, well, we could say, would have been for Du Bois part of that larger Asiatic world.
It's interesting the way conventional U.S. history reduces its figures.
Yeah, absolutely.
Martin Luther King Jr. reduced to the I Have a Dream speech, absolutely, as opposed to his Riverside Church a speech about the United States being the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. Du Bois reduced to the color line.
Well, I mean, King said when Du Bois died, you know, they weren't exactly close friends and allies, but their politics were very different by the late 50s. I mean, that's, you know, Du Bois joined the Communist Party in 1963, the year that King died. But when he died, Du Bois had been blacklisted
and
pilloried, right?
The year that
Malcolm
X died, you mean?
I'm sorry, the year that Du Bois died in 63, King said, look, you know, it's time for us to come to terms with the fact that the greatest black intellectual of the 20th century ended his life as a communist. He wanted that to be part of the historical record. Very few of my students or most of us who even do work on African-American studies would sort of put that quotation at the center of King's thought, but it's, for me, a very important quotation.
And part of your effort is to kind of be an archaeologist, you know, to get out the brush and clear off the sand and show people, you know, what's under there.
Well, the Cold War did a lot to repress and disappear the literature of the left in this country. And people like Carrie Nelson at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, wrote this wonderful book back in the 80s called Repression and Recovery, trying to bring back the proletarian tradition of poetry from the 1930s. Alan Wald at the University of Michigan, who's written this wonderful three-volume trilogy on the left in American literature. We are just beginning to actually understand the history of left-influence writing in the United States. I mean, I would argue that this next 100 years, we might actually begin to see it full.
What is that left influence?
Well, it's there from Haymarket to the writers, the hip hop, the black kids in Iraq who are using hip hop to articulate a criticism of racism and imperialism in war. Right, the left has always been there for African Americans. James Smethurst's book, The New Red Negro. Almost most of the black poets between the 1920 and 1945, Claude McKay being perhaps the best example, had a very close relationship, working relationship with left-wing writers because the left was the only place that racism was openly discussed. My book, Popular Fronts, argues, I think pretty successfully, that people like even Gwendolyn Brooks, who was not thought of as a leftist, was in effect a kind of fellow traveler in the 1940s. And I argued that her first book, Street in Bronzeville, is really a kind of bottom-up view of the South Side of Chicago that catches the flavor and the political message of the organized left and labor movement at that time.
I'm speaking with Bill Mullen here, who is the author of Popular Front, Chicago and African-American Cultural Politics, as well as several other titles, including Left of the Color Line, a book he helped edit. And he has you've got some lines in here, Bill, where you say you want to put the left at the center of American literature and you want minorities as the center of the story of the left in the United States. So that's kind of a double centering, which is interesting. The other thing that interests me is, you know, a lot of people think back on the high points of the left. They look to the 30s and they look to the 60s. And you want us to get over the romanticization of those eras, which you call lost Edens. Why is that important?
Well, I think the romanticization can make us rely too much on a few figures. Langston Hughes, right, sort of stood in for African-American leftism for so many years, or Richard Wright, for that matter, because people like Baldwin and Allison would talk about him. But romanticizing means narrowing. It means fixating on personalities. We don't want to romanticize Barack Obama for the same reason. Left-wing work always gets done across a wide spectrum of organized people. When I wrote my book on Chicago, I got interested in this little magazine called Negro Story, published for 2 years in the 1940s, edited by a social worker and an African-American woman named Alice Browning who just wanted to be a writer.
Well, that must have been fun to discover.
It was extraordinary. But the politics of the magazine, while they were somewhat reformist, they published early work by Richard Wright. They published Chester Himes, who was, I think, one of the great working-class writers of his day. They published lots of stories by black domestics who were not even published writers. These were women who were friends of theirs, who were trying to write poetry. It was really It was really sort of cultural work in its purest form. And this magazine, to me, is just one of the many indices that you find when you start digging beneath the mainstream. The history of mainstream publishing, you start looking at autonomous small magazines and literary magazines, that the left and African Americans have always really, in a way, been in the vanguard of that kind of publishing. Macmillan and Knopf and Putnam were not the publishers that young black writers were going to in that time. In fact, they couldn't get published. That's why they started their own journals like Negro Story.
Bill Mullen is someone who does a lot of digging. He digs and he explores and he exposes. He's been my guest today. He's a professor of English and director of American Studies at Purdue University. And this idea that we shouldn't romanticize because it reduces history just to a few figures and to a few times. Mm. And the fact of the matter is that there is progressive work going on always,
absolutely,
everywhere.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being my guest, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.